From New York Public Radio, this is On the Media. On the Media is produced by WNYC and heard across America on NPR stations. This podcast is made possible by WNYC and its listeners. Support your local public radio station. Visit onthemedia.org to find where On the Media is playing near you. And please help support this free service by becoming a member of WNYC at WNYC.org. WNYC On Demand is supported by Open from American Express, presenting the interactive webcast event, Making a Name for Yourself. Kate and Andy Spade and Bobby Brown discuss their leap from business to brand, created by Open from American Express. Registration at openforumonline.com.
From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Israel unleashes the biggest bombing campaign in Lebanon in decades as a crisis
over major escalation in the Mideast already on edge. Israel's ambassador to the U.S. calls it a major
violence
that
came in the form of volleys back and forth across the border.
The news from the Middle East this week was at once familiar and unusually terrifying. A hostage-taking turned conflagration that quickly engulfed Israel, Lebanon, and Palestine. By Friday, the situation was still escalating, with Syria and Iran suggested as instigators, and the violence was widely portrayed as the brink of full-scale war. Press in the United States struggled to find context and reflexively reviewed the past, but in the Middle East, the press was dealing with the immediate emergency. Susan Caskey is the international editor for The Week magazine, and she joins us once again with a look at the Middle East press reaction. Susan, welcome back to the show.
Good to be here. Thanks.
Let's start with the Arab press outside of Lebanon. The sentiment is split in a kind of a surprising way.
It is. It's interesting that the independent papers in the Arab world are almost uniformly excited and happy about the Hezbollah action. These are London-based papers such as Al-Quds Al-Arabi, Al-Hayat. And it does seem that when you look at the television images going around the Arab world, there is a lot of support in the streets for what Hezbollah is doing. But then you go over and look at the Arab government-run papers, for example, Egypt's state-owned paper Al-Ahram, as well as others in Saudi Arabia and Jordan that are calling for restraint on all sides. The Al-Ahram editorial, in fact, said, we need to stop talking about who started this escalation. All sides should realize that the side that is hurt more than others is Lebanon.
Hezbollah has essentially been holding the government hostage with its de facto veto power in the parliament and controlling South Lebanon. Is there no backlash from those who think that the militants are just endangering the nation that is just now recovering from a long civil war?
Well, that's an interesting question, because I think the answer is yes, but any criticism of Hezbollah is veiled and sort of coded in the Lebanese press. Most of the Lebanese newspapers, they'll start out their editorials and commentaries with praise for the Hezbollah action and say, you know, you brave people who are attacking and resisting and fighting for the Palestinians and fighting for the Lebanese homeland. And then later in the commentary, we'll see a little bit of a kind of a hint that Hezbollah needs to be reined in by other factors. And the way that they hint at this is they'll say, now to move forward, we need real unity among all Lebanese. And there's an undercurrent of fear, it seems, in these commentaries that Lebanon could slip into another civil war. Al-Nahar had another commentary saying, the Lebanese will not fight each other again, despite what happened before.
I want to ask you a question about motivation. Israel left Lebanon, which it had occupied for years, and Hezbollah claimed victory and claimed that it had driven the Zionists out. Is there anything in the press in Lebanon which gets to why they are now sending rockets into Israel and kidnapping Israeli soldiers?
Yes, absolutely. The Lebanese papers are full of opinions as to why Hezbollah chose now to act. And they're pretty unanimous in the opinion that Syria and Iran are pulling the strings. Those two countries fund and support Hezbollah. In a Lebanese paper, Al-Nahar, Sahar Ba'asiri says that this Hezbollah operation christens on the ground the alliance extending from Tehran to Gaza, passing through Syria and Lebanon. So what he's saying there is it's not only Tehran and Hezbollah, but also Gaza, where Hamas is based, that all of them are involved in this.
What about Israel? Whatever you feel about Israel, it's certainly a place where there's, you know, a lively press debate at all times. Is there unanimity there?
Oh, absolutely not. There's never unanimity in the Israeli press. And in fact, in this situation, more than others, there's even a diversity of opinion within the same commentary, which you don't often see. Normally, you'll see, you know, a left-wing Israeli paper saying we should stop the violence and a right-wing paper saying we should go ahead and crush the Palestinians. But instead, many of the centrist and leftist papers are pulling on the other hand, kind of anguished analysis of what's going on. On the one hand, they have to act because there's been this infringement of sovereignty and rockets fired into Israel. On the other hand, nobody wants another war with Lebanon. So there's a real kind of dithering. Then, of course, you do have a certain strand in the right-wing press that says, just go in there and crush them. The Jerusalem Post, which is a conservative paper, came out with its editorial and said, now's the time to eradicate Hezbollah from southern Lebanon and secure the northern border. Also, in several of the centrist papers and the right-wing papers, there's been the strand of argument that says former Prime Minister Ariel Sharon's unilateral withdrawal policy is what is really to blame here for this deteriorating security situation. Benjamin Netanyahu wrote in Ma'ariv, and he said, we pulled out of Lebanon, and Hezbollah took over, and they're attacking us. We pulled out of Gaza, and Hamas took over, and they're attacking us. So obviously, unilateral withdrawal is not working. And so that'll be a debate that will most likely take over the Israeli press after this crisis has passed.
Okay, Susan. Well, as always, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Susan Caskey is international editor of The Week magazine.
Egypt's President Hosni Mubarak is among those trying to defuse the situation in Lebanon. Egypt is a major recipient of U.S. aid and acts sometimes as a moderating force in the region. During Mubarak's 2004 campaign, he promised to end prison sentences for reporters charged with libeling officials. But a proposed new law prompted some 28 independent and opposition papers to strike last Sunday, and hundreds of journalists filled the street in front of the parliament building. That proposed law kept open the possibility of prison terms for journalists who criticized the president, his cabinet, or the parliament, and it passed Monday despite the protests. But Mubarak did remove the clause that would jail journalists for reporting on the financial improprieties of officials. Since corruption is rife in that nation, that was seen as a small victory in a much larger war. Heba Saleh reports from Cairo for the BBC. She said the protest also was small, but it made a big point.
I was there. There were maybe 100 journalists, and they were surrounded by hundreds of riot police and countless officers milling around. There was no tension, but there was an attempt to keep it small and ensure that it did not grow and that it did not move from its place.
Now, during Mubarak's presidential campaign in 2004, he made some promises regarding the press, that it would have more freedom and that it would be able to report on the government.
More specifically, he made a promise that he would abolish prison sentences for journalists. And that's what angered the press when they found out about the new law, because even though prison sentences for some offenses were abolished, there are other offenses that are still punishable by prison. And these are insulting the president, insulting public institutions like the cabinet or parliament, and also insulting the heads of foreign governments. But a new offense was introduced, and that's the offense of casting doubts on the financial integrity of public officials, which really means speaking out against corruption. And President Mubarak intervened on Monday, finally, and did away with the prison part of the punishment, though he doubled the fine.
Since corruption is such a huge problem in Egypt, what is it that you can report on if you can't report on corruption freely?
I think journalists will still be able to report on corruption. The fines will limit the tendency to launch unsubstantiated attacks. I think it will force journalists to work harder to get the information that they need to have before criticizing anyone of corruption. And I I just think that even though the fines are high, they're not going to be high enough to stop a paper that's really determined and that has information on corruption from going public with it.
Can you tell me how the independent press in Egypt has grown in the 2 years since Mubarak made those earlier promises of freedom?
There are now at least 10 or 12 new papers, I would say, and these have become very bold in the last 2 years. The U.S. has been pressing for democratic reform in the Middle East, and the U.S. singled out Egypt as a country which should lead the region in democracy. And also there was the anti-war movement, and that emboldened many people to take on the government. And of course, Mr. Mubarak has been saying last year that Egypt is reforming. That's partly the response to U.S. pressure. He announced last year that for the first time Egypt would have contested presidential elections and that he was leading the country into a new democratic era. So this all has changed the atmosphere.
On the other hand, it wasn't an entirely consistent change. There was an editor and a journalist at an independent paper who were sentenced in April for reporting on a lawsuit against Mubarak, his wife and his son.
They're appealing their sentence now, but people have taken this as a very ominous sign that the reforms have turned out to be more cosmetic than many people had hoped they would be. And of course, the U.S. has fallen silent on reform, and that's another thing that's very often commented upon. The activists have never counted on U.S. pressure on Mr. Mubarak because they say that they cannot really rely on it to stay the course. And they're saying now that they've been proved correct.
The one element that we've left out of this discussion is probably the most influential news outlet in Egypt, which is Al Jazeera.
Yes, I think it's the satellite broadcasters who are actually creating the pressure on the printed press to become more interesting, to become more varied, to reflect what's really happening. And it is the presence of the satellite broadcaster that's also, in a way, sort of staying the hands of governments from being even more repressive. I mean, of course, they are repressive, but they could be even more repressive across the region towards the newspaper. So at any one point, there is an Arab government which is not very happy with Al Jazeera.
Heba, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Heba Saleh reports from Cairo for the BBC.
Coming up, TV takes on the tough issues in Pakistan and the 10th birthday of the troubled middle child of cable news.
This is On the Media from NPR. This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. In 1979, Pakistan's military dictator, General Muhammad Zia-ul-Haq, instituted a set of laws collectively known as the Hudood Ordinance. Based on Muslim custom, but not necessarily Islamic law, the rules covered adultery, fornication, alcohol consumption, lying, and stealing. The Hudood Ordinance imposes harsh ancient punishments, such as stoning for women, even rape victims, convicted of adultery. Pakistan's current military strongman, Colonel Pervez Musharraf, has tried to reverse or moderate the Hudud Ordinance, only to be stymied by hardline Islamist objections. But this year, an independent TV station called GeoTV opened up the issue for debate, not as a matter of social policy, but as an interpretation of the Quran. As a result, the law is now being reviewed, permitting Musharraf to release more than 1,000 accused women from prison on bail. Their cases are still pending, but it's a start. Gretchen Peters is covering the story for ABC News. She joins us now from Islamabad. Gretchen, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
At least two previous governments before Musharraf have actually attempted to either repeal or substantially amend the Hudud Ordinance, but failed completely. But this television show on GeoTV seems to have just changed everything. Tell me about GeoTV and its background, please.
Geo and a handful of other private networks have all sprung up over the last 5 years. Before that, Pakistan had nothing other than its state TV program, Pakistan TV. And when I first started working in this country about a decade ago, when you'd go to press conferences, you'd see nothing else but the Associated Press camera, Reuters television, sometimes the BBC would be there, and PTV. These days, there are about 30 private channels. A lot of the big ones like Geo are broadcast out of other countries, out of Dubai or Abu Dhabi, presumably because of fears that the Pakistan government might shut them down. They've been very critical of the Pakistan government on many occasions, most especially in the weeks after the massive earthquake that struck this country last year in October. Geo has proved to be very feisty, and both in terms of the entertainment that it puts on, but also its breaking news coverage, and people tend to be glued to it across the country. This program about the Hudud Ordinance again turns a corner at the role that private television is playing in Pakistan.
The talk show, Zara Sosia, Just Think, that took an interesting approach because in discussing the Hudud Ordinance, it did not have sort of the usual suspects. It did not have women's rights groups. It did not have representatives of foreign NGOs or academics other than Islamic scholars. Tell me why.
Well, one of the reasons past governments have failed to repeal or amend the Hudud Ordinance is that the religious parties here, and they are very powerful, although they are a minority, the minute anyone tries to go against something like this, whether it is the Hudud Ordinance or other religious edicts that have become law, they denounce the person or the group as un-Islamic, and then the entire public swings behind them. And, of course, we have a relatively uneducated populace here in Pakistan. So that's something that has been a major stumbling block for previous efforts to do something about the Hudud Ordinance. This program took a very, very clever approach to the situation by bringing Islamic scholars, some of them moderate, some of them more conservative. It's also a debate that has Pakistani people for the first time in public using the internet, using telephones. The public is calling in, taking part in this discussion. That's the real issue here.
Now, I mean, before we get too irrationally exuberant about this, I guess we should observe that however the Hudud Ordinance has been, let's say, effectively moderated, would I be wildly condescending to suggest that this is sort of dragging the country kicking and screaming into the 19th century?
Well, certainly you could say that, and it would only be the 19th century, not the 20th. One issue that comes up here is that in the villages, no matter what law is in place, tribal law will prevail. We routinely read things in the local newspapers about a young girl being given as a bride to a rival family because there's been some dispute over land, you know, women being given to other families as a way to settle some sort of dispute between the two tribes. So getting rid of the Hudud Ordinance is not going to go very far unless they can implement some kind of justice that reaches the countryside and provide better education for their people.
But as to the role of the media in all of this, do we have any reason to think that this is the beginning of a trend?
Well, I think that's what a lot of Pakistanis and certainly a lot of us who watch Pakistan closely are waiting to see. President Musharraf has ordered one amendment already to the Hudud Ordinance and has asked legal scholars to look at other amendments to it. So I think we're seeing the beginning of something that could spawn changes to this very draconian and medieval set of laws. And I think many Pakistanis quietly hope that will happen. I think not enough people in the world realize that there exists a very quiet majority here who would like to see Pakistan become a more moderate, more open, and more democratic country.
Okay, Gretchen. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Gretchen Peters is a reporter and producer. She works for ABC News from Islamabad.
Good evening, I'm Chris Matthews. Welcome to Hardball.
Exciting, ain't it? Chris Matthews is one of a few exciting voices on MSNBC. Keith Olbermann is another, not that it matters. The fact is, after 10 long years of identity crisis, MSNBC forever limps behind its competition. It was supposed to attract a generation of young internet-savvy news watchers who would switch eagerly between the channel and its sister website. They were, after all, the eugenically designed offspring of NBC and Microsoft. Here's how that newborn channel sounded when it was born on July 15, 1996. Brian Williams was there at the start, so was Jane Pauley. Soledad O'Brien hosted a show about the internet called The Site.
You're connected to MSNBC.
But the droves of tech-savvy viewers never tuned in. By 2002, MSNBC's news was being crowded out by chat. It lurched briefly to the left with Phil Donahue, and then to the right with shock jock Michael Savage, until a horrifying anti-gay rant got him fired. Still, if the channel was a lemon, the website was the golden egg. Today, MSNBC.com often is the top-rated online destination for news. So this weekend, while the channel checks its pulse, the website can actually party. Brian Stelter writes the blog TV Newser. Brian, glad to have you back.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
So we know MSNBC's ratings have never been anything to celebrate, but how are they doing right now compared to CNN and Fox? A little behind or way behind?
For the most part, way behind. The network is still in third place, where it's been for many years. In prime time, it averages 200, 300, 400,000 viewers for their hourly broadcasts. In prime time, Fox gets up to 2 million viewers a night with O'Reilly and Hannity and Colmes and Greta Van Susteren.
Why has MSNBC failed to get a foothold?
The usual answer is that MSNBC has always had an identity crisis. CNN traditionally has represented a solid news network that breaks news and handles international stories well. Fox traditionally has been a more opinionated talk format, especially in the evening. MSNBC is more of a question mark. When it launched 10 years ago, the whole idea was to meld internet and TV in the first real combination of the two. The original slogan of MSNBC was, "It's time to get connected." It never really happened, though. Maybe it was ahead of its time. Maybe people didn't want to get connected between the TV and the internet. I think part of the issue is that there may not be room for three cable news networks.
So we see MSNBC's numbers trailing far behind CNN and especially Fox, but the picture is pretty much reversed online.
That's right. Fox News is almost an also-ran at this point. Online, CNN.com and MSNBC.com compete for number one. MSNBC.com especially has been very aggressive with video and with multimedia and with blogs. Also, it has that connection to NBC News that MSNBC, the cable channel, has never really been able to tap into. They've done an outstanding job after Hurricane Katrina, putting reporters who are dedicated only to the website on the ground in Mississippi and doing daily updates only on the internet. MSNBC's never been able to even double or triple their viewership, but MSNBC.com has added 10 times the visitors, about 30 million unique visitors per month.
If news, as we've reported on the show, seems to be moving to a new set of pipes, like, say, cell phones or other mobile devices, is MSNBC.com then well-placed?
I think MSNBC is perfectly positioned to do that. For instance, you can watch NBC Nightly News or Meet the Press in its full unedited form a few hours after its broadcast. And NBC was one of the first news channels to try that. I've always said that the holy grail for MSNBC would be to have every segment it airs on cable available online. It wouldn't work because of the cable distribution agreements, but that's really the future. It might give less pressure for cable just to stick to the tabloid stories of the day if they know there's an audience online.
We already know that the numbers of people who are getting their news from the internet has just grown enormously and continues to grow at a great rate. But where does that leave broadcast news, and where especially does that leave cable news?
Well, a fellow TV news analyst of mine, Andrew Tindall, once said that when we look back, we're going to see cable as just a transitional medium between broadcast and online news.
Sort of the 8-track tape of news?
I think so. I definitely agree that cable in 10 or 20 years may not serve the same function it serves now. Certainly, we tune to MSNBC when an election happens or when a Hurricane Katrina happens. But we don't really watch in between. Most viewers don't anyway. Maybe a couple hundred thousand every night. You just don't need cable news on an hourly basis.
So when CNN and Fox News Channel find themselves migrating to the online format as a principal format, they'll find an estimable competitor in MSNBC.com. But the news channel?
I think we'll have to wait and see if it's still around 10 years from now. And if so, is it anything like what we know it now? Maybe there is room for 3 cable news channels, but I'm betting there's not.
All right. Brian, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Brian Stelter writes the essential cable blog, TV Newser.
On June 17th, the Washington Post reported on the front page of its financial section, quote, "The recent breakup of the Knight Ridder newspaper chain has helped spark interest around the country in returning papers to local or private ownership after decades of expansion by corporate media conglomerates." Of course, this sentiment has been simmering for years amid layoffs and cutbacks that Wall Street cared more about earnings than good journalism. But less than 3 weeks after that Washington Post piece ran, 6 senior staff members of the Santa Barbara News Press walked out when that paper's local and private owner took a sledgehammer to the wall that traditionally separates the editorial page from the newsroom. 2 more have since resigned, and the whole affair, says Fortune magazine editor-at-large Justin Fox, is a reminder to be careful of what we wish for. He joins us now to explain. Justin, welcome to On the Media.
Thanks for having me.
Now, in defense of the publicly held model, you speak of, if what I'm not mistaken, is the efficient market theory, that Wall Street, in the aggregate of all the information that it amasses every day, simply knows better than any single owner. Can you give me any evidence that that's true?
Evidence, schmevidence. All I can say is it's pretty clear that publicly held corporations are just as or even more likely to invest for the long run, to put money into R&D, to find ways to grow than privately held companies. And so, yeah, over industries in general, I would say there's pretty good evidence that the market does a pretty good job of looking into the future and saying, hey, this is a good place to steer money and this isn't.
Then there's the Knight Ridder organization. For many years, Knight Ridder was deemed the gold standard in newspaper chains because it ran some great papers under corporate ownership, the San Jose Mercury, the Miami Herald, the Philadelphia Inquirer. But those papers have become shadows of their former self. So which are we to credit, the Knight Ridder of 20 years ago or the Knight Ridder that just withered on the vine?
Well, yeah, the pressure from Wall Street maybe accelerated things. But the initial problem is that regional daily newspapers are in really deep trouble. There's a place for national media. There's a place for sort of hyper-local media. But it's just not clear what the market is for the kind of papers like the Philadelphia Inquirer or the Boston Globe or maybe even the LA Times that aren't really national papers, that don't appeal to a national audience, but yet have national aspirations. It's just not clear to me that there's a way to support that if you don't have this monopoly stranglehold on classified advertising and readers in your region anymore because of the internet. And so to say that these papers wouldn't be facing a struggle if they were all owned by nutty local billionaires, I mean, I think eventually they would.
Well, I don't know the last time that the Philadelphia Inquirer had national aspirations. It strikes me that's probably about 20 years ago.
Right.
But let's talk about them for a moment because they have just been acquired by a local ownership group headed by a guy who's an advertising man. That group has actually pledged to keep their hands off the editorial product, not only the editorial product, but the editorial page itself. What do you make of that situation?
I would guess one of the issues with that group is it's a relatively diverse group of people who put money into it. And the one thing that brought them all together is that they wanted to bring the Inquirer's ownership back to Philadelphia. And they may not agree on anything else. So it may, to a certain extent, just be a way of preventing them from all wringing each other's necks. I hope it works out in Philadelphia. And one thing I will say is that I think there should be different ways of running newspapers. But I do think that just thinking that, okay, having David Geffen buy the LA Times and having these locals buy the Inquirer and having Wendy McCaw buy the Santa Barbara paper, that that's going to automatically make them better, I think that's a little bit delusional.
Now, without going into a whole lot of the particulars of the Santa Barbara case, in which the private owner, Wendy McCaw, basically put a battering ram to the division between the executive suite and the newsroom in protecting a movie star friend of hers and someone within the organization who had been arrested on drunk driving charges. In some sense, isn't the publisher's intervention like that just sort of a return to the bad old days?
Yeah. And the question is just how bad it gets. I mean, that wall is, at least at papers I've worked at, there's always been a little bit of porousness there, and there's definitely some influence from the publisher. In McCaw's case, it's because her demands were so absurd that people fought back.
Okay, yes, maybe Wendy McCaw has acted obnoxiously in Santa Barbara. And, you know, maybe we should be a little bit fearful that Brian Tierney, the head of the ownership group in Philadelphia, has talked about bringing an ad agency in to redesign the paper, as opposed to people with a sort of journalistic ethos. Putting that aside for a second, can we draw really any conclusions about private ownership from these two fairly anomalous stories?
Well, you can draw a lot of conclusions about private ownership of newspapers by just looking back half a century and seeing what American newspapers were like. The Chicago Tribune, when it was privately owned, was a national disgrace. It was this reactionary, incredibly biased joke of a newspaper in a lot of ways. It was very successful financially, but it was really hard to take seriously. Since Tribune Company became a publicly held company, it's been a pretty good paper. It's not the best paper in the world, but it's significantly better than it was under private ownership. So I would just say private ownership is a mishmash. Sometimes it's great, sometimes it's horrible. It doesn't solve all the problems that newspapers are facing.
Okay. Well, Justin, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
Justin Fox is an editor-at-large for Fortune magazine.
Coming up, the scandalous father of civil liberties.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the Kresge Foundation, investing in nonprofits to help them catalyze growth, connect to stakeholders, and challenge greater support. On the web at kresge.org. The Wallace Foundation, supporting ideas, sharing solutions, expanding opportunities. On the web at wallacefoundation.org. And the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, committed to helping Americans lead healthier lives and get the care they need. On the web at rwjf.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Let's say your taste in Hollywood movies runs along the lines of the chaste and nonviolent, and yet you still don't want to be excluded from the cultural zeitgeist that is Die Hard 2, Die Harder. Or say you are under 10 and want to hold off adulthood for a few years and still enjoyed the visual delights of Kill Bill Volume 1. Your options are limited, or at least they were until 7 years ago when Ray Lines created Clean Flicks, a film sanitizing service that edits Hollywood films of, quote, sex, nudity, profanity, and gory violence. What does clean sound like exactly? Lines brought us the film Training Day, starring Denzel Washington as a crooked L.A. cop, a violent film riddled with obscenity. Here's the original finale.
You think you can do this to me? You motherfuckers will be playing basketball in Pelican Bay when I get finished with you. Shoe program, 23-hour lockdown. I'm the man up in this piece. You'll never see the light of day. Who the f*** you think you f***ing with? I'm the police. I run s***. You just live here.
That was the original version. Here's the cleaned up one.
You think you can do this to me? Shoe program, nigga. 23-hour lockdown. I'm the man up in this piece. You'll never see the light of day. I'm the police. I run s***. You just live here.
Not every word escaped the sanitizing. We decided that the N-word in this context was gratuitous and bleeped it out ourselves. Lines didn't. We asked him why the racial slur made the cut.
The reason that we would leave in the N-word in Training Day is, first of all, you've got a black actor saying it. Our customers were the ones that told us what to take out. So, you know, an F-word had to go, a deity reference had to go, S-words, B-words, damns and hells, that kind of thing. We've never had a customer send us an email or respond and say, you've got to take out the N-word. And so we would leave it in.
Lines' work won him a national audience and a legion of imitators. That is, until last week when Clean Flicks and its competitors lost a 4-year fight with the Directors Guild of America in the U.S. District Court and were ordered to shut down for copyright violation. Lines will comply with the order. There is a slight chance he'll appeal, but it's likely the end of a mini-industry that began when Lines was asked by a neighbor in Salt Lake City to remove the brief nudity in Titanic.
I did that, and then it was Braveheart and Jerry Maguire and Saving Private Ryan, and the list just grew and grew and grew, and it snowballed into a very big snowball.
Saving Private Ryan. Now, that is a film that is just absolutely laced with profanity, with violent death. How in the world do you sanitize it?
It's a very good question. That movie's almost 3 hours long. How many minutes do you think we edited out of that film?
I'd say 30.
Less than 7 minutes is what we took out of that film. And everybody says to that response, that probably came out of the first 25 minutes of that film when all the violence was happening. And I said, no, we took out less than 2 minutes out of that first battle sequence. If you look at the way we would edit a film, we would go out of our way not to ruin the plot, to ruin the story. It's much like you'd see on the airlines, much like you'd see on network television. And there have been titles, for example, Basic Instinct or Pulp Fiction. I believe Pulp Fiction had 350 F-words in it that we couldn't do because after we got through doing it, there was no movie left or the movie didn't make any sense. You know, a lot of people wanted me to edit Caddyshack all these years. And every time we tried to edit Caddyshack, the final product just did not work at all. It wasn't funny. It wasn't Caddyshack, and so we always backed away from that one.
Now, your legal argument in all of this was based on fair use. That is the ability to excerpt stuff that's out there in the popular culture, much as you would quote from a film or show a clip on TV. But the court said, not so fast.
Yeah, we argued 2 points to fair use. The first point is that it's for the good of the people, and we believe that our customers, it's for the good of them. And then the other point of fair use was there's no economic impact because every movie that we edit, you have to buy the original. And so it's not like some guy in a back room somewhere just copying movies like in a black market situation. You had to have the original movie for us to edit it for you. And the ones that we rented out from Clean Flicks, we bought originals for every single one of those. So we kept it with 1-to-1 ratio. And we just feel that if you purchase a movie, you should have the right as a consumer to bring it to a company like Clean Flicks and have it altered so that you can watch it in the privacy of your own home.
In a statement following the decision, Directors Guild of America President Michael Apted, himself a director, said, among other things, that audiences can now be assured that the films they buy or rent are the vision of the filmmakers who made them and not the arbitrary choices of a third-party editor. But my understanding is that your customers explicitly want the choices of a third-party editor and that it's actually impossible for them to accidentally get the sanitized version.
People that buy Clean Flicks movies or bring their movies in and get them edited know exactly what they're getting, know exactly what they want. When I first started doing this, for example, I left in words like damn and hell. You know, well, it wasn't too long after that that my customer said, you got to take it out. You got to take it all out. And so we had to change and evolve as we did this, what we did.
How big was the market for this kind of sanitized product? Were you making a living doing this?
Yeah, we were making a living doing it. I wouldn't say that we were making a big living. It's kind of funny, you know, when Hollywood's talking about money in this deal, because we haven't made a lot of money. We've incurred a lot of debt. If we decide to shut our doors and fold up our tent, you know, I'm going to end up with hundreds of thousands of dollars in debt. But to me, it was worth it. I always said to a lot of Hollywood producers that we used to debate on radio and TV, would you be okay if I didn't charge money to do this? Would it be okay then? I'd be willing to find a way to do that. And they said, oh, well, then, even though it's not about the money, we still don't want you to do it.
One explanation for Hollywood's reaction could be, I guess, if you were suspicious enough, like me, that actually the studios want to have this business of sanitizing all of themselves. They're already in the cleaning up business for airliners and for television. Maybe they see this as a market niche that they can themselves exploit. Do you have any suspicions like that, or do you really think this was an act of principle by the Directors Guild?
The short answer is I think it was an act of principle. The long answer is I would love it. Put me out of business. I'd welcome it. Because my goal when I started this was to have a Clean Flicks in every town in America. And we were able to accomplish that with our website. But if the Hollywood studios and the directors now will make their titles available in four versions, a cleaned-up version, a director's cut, the normal cut, and the airline version, then I'm totally happy and I've reached my goal.
All right, Ray. Well, thank you so much.
You bet. My pleasure.
Ray Lines is the founder and CEO of Clean Flicks.
Possibly the dirtiest poem in the English language was written by John Wilkes in the 1760s. It almost ended his career. The son of a well-to-do distiller, Wilkes was at various times an exile, a jailbird, a mayor of London, and a member of Parliament, elected three times from prison. His private life was notorious, crowded with mistresses, buried in debt, punctuated by duels. His face was equally shocking, with crossed and squinty eyes and a jutting lower jaw that exposed some stunningly awful teeth. But he was adored by the unwashed mobs in London and venerated by the founding fathers across the water in the future United States of America. The reason? John Wilkes loved civil liberties as much as he loved sex, and despite his looks, he had enough grit and charm to win them both. Arthur Cash is the author of John Wilkes, the Scandalous Father of Civil Liberties. He quotes Wilkes saying that he needed only 20 minutes to talk away his face.
He really was a sight, but what a personality. He was completely uninhibited and unembarrassed and a daredevil.
He was a famous wit. One of his former friends turned foe, Lord Sandwich, once shouted to him, "You, sir, will die either of the pox or the gallows." And Wilkes responded, "That would depend on whether I embrace your lordship's mistresses or your principles."
That was the man.
But you say that he was a daredevil. So tell me about that.
Well, he began by writing this weekly paper that he called the North Briton, which was a weekly essay on the politics of the time. And he was attacking very strongly the first ministry of the very young King George III.
Particularly in the 45th edition of Wilkes's paper, The North Briton, and thereby hangs the tale.
Thereby hangs the tale. He was arrested for the North Briton under a general warrant. A general warrant was one that did not name the criminal, but named the crime. And the warrant had said, go out and find the author, publisher and printer of North Britain No. 45 and bring them in to the Secretaries of State. They arrested 49 people in order to get three. It was scandalous. They did eventually get Wilkes and sent him to the Tower of London. And after his release, he went home, found his house had been sacked, and he sued the government for invasion of his privacy and for false arrest. It was unheard of for private people to sue the government. And he won all of those suits. And so those two rights were for the first time recognized in the courts.
Now, there were a number of ways, you recount in the book, in which Wilkes fought for freedom of the press. He certainly did it through lawsuits. He also seemed to do it, to some degree, through duels.
That's right. When he was writing the North Britain, the government was constantly trying to find out who the author was because it was written anonymously. It was an open secret. Everybody knew Wilkes was writing it, but they had no proof. Lord Talbot was the head of the king's household, and he was very insulted because Wilkes had written this funny essay about him at the coronation of the king when he was supposed to ride his horse into Westminster Hall and salute the king and ride out again. But he was trying to outdo everybody else, and so he rode his horse in and backed his horse out. He'd been training the horse for weeks and weeks to do this. When the time came, the horse got very nervous, all these people all around, and the horse came into the hall and turned around and backed up to the king, and the crowds of people just roared with laughter and clapped and clapped. And so Lord Talbot was terribly embarrassed when Wilkes wrote about this in the North Britain, and he insisted upon finding out who had written it so that he could charge him. And Wilkes said, "You have no right to know. This is published anonymously." And eventually the contention ended up in a duel. Everybody's very suspicious that they both fired the pistols in the air, but never mind. It settled their quarrel. Afterwards, they went into the tavern. They had some wine together. They called each other fine fellows, and they went about their business.
But was Wilkes at that point really protecting the principle of anonymity, or was he just protecting his own identity?
No, I think he was protecting the principle of anonymity, but there's at the same time, there's not much doubt about it, that he was getting some very good publicity out of this.
You call Wilkes the father of the modern newspaper. How is he the father?
Well, this happened a few years later. At this time, Wilkes had served 2 years in prison for his insults of the government, but he was out. And he was very active in the City of London government. Now, you have to understand, in those days, there was a distinction between the City of London and the City of Westminster. They were different political entities. Anyway, Wilkes got two of his friends, one of whom was the Lord Mayor, and another one, who was also, along with Wilkes, an alderman, that is, ran one of the wards of the City of London. And these three pulled a trick. They got their printers to print the accounts of the debates in the House of Commons. This was against the law. Well, the House of Commons ordered the printers to come before them. They didn't come. So the House of Commons sent their policemen into the City of London to find these guys.
But since Parliament was in Westminster and the printers were in the city,
Wilkes and his friends said, "You are trying to arrest citizens of the City of London. You have no authority under the City of London. Into jail you go." Well, everybody in the government was just furious with this. The poor man didn't stay in jail very long, of course, but they had made their point. And the net result of all this, the hoopla that was raised around this event, the House of Commons finally gave up.
They had enjoyed blanket secrecy, protection from reporting, for as long as there'd been a parliament until Wilkes kicked up this fuss. And here's what I want to ask you. As he was doing all of this in England, what was his impact on civil liberties in the emerging nation of the United States of America?
Well, he had an enormous impact, especially during that 10-year period before the fighting actually broke out. The Americans, for a very, very long time, had no intention of going to war. What they were looking for was a way to live with this king and this House of Commons who were being so unreasonable to them. And they looked to John Wilkes as the model of a man who could protest the tyrannies of the government without himself breaking the law. And that's what they wanted. So they idolized Wilkes. They followed his arrest.
They sent him big turtles to eat when he was in prison.
And he corresponded with them. He corresponded with the two Adams.
Sam and John Adams.
Yes. And he had a very strong impact upon the Constitution. One of the things we haven't talked about was how Parliament had failed to seat him. They put somebody in his place. They appointed someone.
You could elect somebody, as John Wilkes was elected, and then be barred from the House of Commons if they decided you shouldn't be there.
Not at all uncommon, actually. Wilkes is one case among quite a few. This had a great effect upon James Madison at the Constitutional Convention, so that in our Constitution, Article 1, Section 2, and Section 3 spelled out the qualifications for members of Congress. They must be 25 years old or 30 years old, depending on which house. They must be residents of the place they live. These simple qualifications were built into the law. What had happened in England, they didn't have anything like that. So the House of Commons thought that they had a ride ad hoc on each case to decide whether somebody was worthy of coming in with them or not.
And then you had a situation where people were in a position of being, say, taxed without actual representation, an idea that underpinned the American Revolution.
Absolutely. The other thing is the First and the Third Amendments to the Constitution in the Bill of Rights have to do with freedom from false arrest, freedom of privacy, freedom of the press, and freedom of speech.
And they derive directly from John Wilkes's lawsuits and his duels?
Well, if you read my book, and then you read the Third Amendment, the Third Amendment is just John Wilkes's experience.
Did John Wilkes love liberty as much as an old man as he did as a young one?
Oh, absolutely. He never quit. He stayed in Parliament until he was too old, actually. But when he was in Parliament in all those years, after the war had broken out, he was always the champion of the Americans. And that country, for him, was a country that he thought would stand up for freedom. He said in Parliament one day, "I rejoice that liberty will have a resting place, a sure asylum in America."
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Arthur Cash is author of John Wilkes, The Scandalous Father of Civil Liberty.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Megan Ryan, Tony Field, Jamie York, and Mike Volo, and edited by Brooke. Dylan Keefe is our technical director and Jennifer Munson our engineer, and we had engineering help from Rob Christensen. We also had help from Mark Phillips, Noah Kuman, and Claire Peters. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer and John Keefe our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. This is On the Media from WNYC. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
On the Media is supported by Ciaobella Gelato, purveyors of all-natural gelato and sorbet. Ciaobella is available nationwide at specialty food markets. More information at ciaobellagelato.com or 1-800-GELATO-3. Support for On the Media also comes from the Bidell Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the John and Anna Maria Phillips Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
Thanks for checking out this week's On the Media from WNYC, New York Public Radio. Support your local public radio station. Visit onthemedia.org to find where On the Media is playing near you. And please help support this free service by becoming a member of WNYC at WNYC.org. And thanks.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at the New Yorker. So join us every week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.